November the 17th, 1961, Lecture 15. November the 17th, 1961, Lecture 15. November the 17th, 1961, Lecture 15. November 17th, 1961, Lecture 15, Relativity. November 17th, 1961, Lecture 15, Relativity. November 17th, 1961, Lecture 15, Relativity.
Nobody's left. Well, here they come. The equations of motion of Newton, which we've been studying so far, were believed to be right for over 200 years. And the first time that an error was discovered, incorrectly discovered, that is, in the laws of Newton was by Einstein in 1905. The equation of Newton, which is the ddt of mv, is equal to the force. Newton added the hypothesis that m is a constant. But it's been found that isn't true, that the correct formula is that m is a constant, which I'll call m0, divided by the square root of 1 minus the square of the speed over the speed of light squared. C is the speed of light and is 300,000 kilometers per second. So the whole result is that. That's all. It's the end of the lecture. For those people who only want to learn exactly what they have to learn in order to know something so they can solve problems, this is all there is to the theory of relativity. It just changes Newton's laws by adding this factor in the mass. First of all, let us remark that this mass change is very small under ordinary circumstances. If the velocity is even as high as the velocity of a satellite, say, going around the Earth at 5 miles a second, since C is 186,000 miles a second, V over C is 1 in 20,000, and therefore the correction to the mass is approximately 1 in a billion, which is quite difficult to discover. The easiest way to deal with this subject from a sheer learning point of view is simply say it's been since we have lots of particles that go over at any arbitrary speed as close as you want to the speed of light, and we've observed that this is true, and that's all there is to it. However, because the effect is so small, it's rather remarkable that it was discovered so early. That is, it was discovered before it was discovered empirically. It's got a very big empirical effect, but it wasn't discovered that way. And it's therefore of great interest to see how such a law with such a delicate modification, at least at the time when it was first discovered, now when the velocities are small, can have been discovered by the combination of experiment and physical reasoning. And this was done by a number of people put together, of which the final result was Einstein's final discovery. Incidentally, for your interest, there are two Einstein theories of relativity. One is called the special theory, which was made in 1905, and that's what we're going to discuss today. So strictly, this lecture should be called the special theory of relativity. By 1915, he had another theory, an additional theory, called the general theory of relativity. This latter deals with the extension of the ideas of the former theory to the case of the theory of gravitation. That we won't discuss here. Now I'll go on to discuss this theory of relativity. First, I want to state the principle of relativity. One way to state it is the following. The motion of bodies included in a given space are the same among themselves, whether this space is at rest or moves uniformly forwards in a straight line. Don't copy it down. Just listen to what it says. Now, that means, otherwise you don't understand anything when you get finished. That means that if a whole lot of objects are in a spaceship and the whole spaceship is drifting along at a uniform speed, then the experiments done in the spaceship will appear the same. All the phenomena in the spaceship will appear the same as whether that car is moving or it is not moving, provided, of course, that you don't look outside. That's the principle of relativity. To state it again, if you promise me not to copy it down, and I'll say it again, this time, oh, I left the other note, the other quotation. I won't state it again, I'm sorry. The question is, of course, having understood what it means, the idea is simple enough. The only question is whether it's true. The question is whether, in a moving system, doing all experiments inside, the laws of physics will appear the same as they would if the system is standing still. Now, first, let's investigate whether it's true according to Newton's laws. We've already investigated this several times. We noticed that if Mr. Moore is a man who is moving, and he measures the position of a point and calls the distance from his coordinate system x prime, and Joe is a man at rest and measures a point from his x, and that the relation between the two is that since Mo is moving, his center is moved away by a distance v times the time, where v is the velocity, that I'm going to call vu. Then the relationship between the various coordinates is clear from the diagram, as x prime is x minus ut and so on. Now we discovered that if we take Newton's laws and substitute this transformation of coordinates into them, and then these laws transform to a new set with all primes. In other words, the laws of Newton are the same in form in the moving system as well as in the stationary one, and therefore you can't tell by making mechanical experiments whether the system is moving or not. In fact, Newton first stated the principle of relativity, and the statement which I read to you was a quotation from Newton. So the principle of relativity has been with us a long time. It was used by various people, in particular Huygens, to obtain the rules for the collision of billiard balls, much in the same way as we used it here in discussing the conservation of angular momentum. So what's all the excitement? The excitement is this, that physics does not stand still, that during the intervening years, the phenomena of electricity and magnetism and light were investigated and studied carefully, culminating in the Maxwell's equations, which describes electricity, magnetism, and light in one uniform system. Now, the thing that's interesting is that the Maxwell equations did not seem to obey the principle of relativity. That is to say, if I took Maxwell's equations and made that substitution in them, their form did not remain the same. Therefore, there would be phenomena, electrical and optical phenomena, which would be different in a moving ship than one standing still. And thus, you could use these optical phenomena to determine the speed of the ship. In particular, for example, you could determine the speed of the Earth, absolute speed of the Earth, by making suitable optical measurements or electrical measurements. Now, let me give one illustration of a measurement to give you a quick idea of what I would talk about. One of the consequences of the Maxwell's equations is that if there's a disturbance, then light is generated, or electromagnetic waves, depending on the frequency, of course, is generated, and that these waves go out in all directions equally and at the same speed, which is 186,000 miles a second, or c. So if a light is going along here, it goes at the speed c, and it also is a consequence of the same equations, that if the disturbing thing is moving, the light comes out at the same speed. It's like sound. It doesn't make any difference whether the source is moving. The sound just goes at the same speed. So the speed is independent of the source movement. Therefore, we have an interesting problem. So we have a car here, and we let a light source go out. Well, we say we're riding in this car, and somebody sends light past it going at the speed c, and the car is going at the speed v. Then, of course, according to those things here, if you differentiate, you get that the speed measured, the derivative of x prime, differs from the other speed by the speed u. Excuse me, the car is going at the speed u. Therefore, the apparent speed of the light shouldn't be 186,000, but should be that less the speed of the car. For instance, if the car is going 100,000 miles a second, and the light's going 186,000 miles a second, then apparently the light going in past the car should go at 86,000 miles a second. And therefore, by measuring the speed of light in the car, because it doesn't make any difference whether the light was sent from something outside or something inside, make a little hole, let it go through, and measure the light, it should be a different velocity. And thus, one could determine the speed of the car by measuring the behavior of light. Well, a number of experiments were performed with this general idea in mind to determine the velocity of the Earth, and they all failed. They all gave no velocity. We'll discuss one of these experiments in detail in order to show what was done exactly and what was the matter. Something was the matter, of course. Something was wrong with the equations of physics. Now, the first thing to think of course, is that the new equations, the Maxwell equations of electrodynamics, since they're mostly new and they were only 20 years old, were obviously the ones that were wrong. So the thing to do is to change them around so that they will satisfy the principle of relativity with this transformation. People tried that, I think. But they found that there were new phenomena predicted by new terms that they had to put into the equation, new electrical phenomena, which didn't exist at all when they tried it experimentally. So that didn't work. And so it gradually became apparent that the laws of electrodynamics were probably quite good. In the meantime, Lorentz noticed a very remarkable curiosity, which was that if he made the following substitutions in the Maxwell equation, x prime equals x minus ut, over the square root of 1 minus u square over c square, y prime equal y, z prime equals z, and t prime is equal to t minus ux over c squared over the square root of 1 minus u squared over c squared, which is different than this. If he made that substitution in the Maxwell equations, this transformation called the Lorentz transformation, then the Maxwell equation would remain the same in form. Now, what Einstein's, actually it was Poincaré's idea originally, was to propose this, that all the physical laws should be of such a kind that this is the right transformation to make so that they remain unchanged. In other words, we will change the laws not of electrodynamics, but the laws of mechanics. We'll change Newton's laws so that they won't remain unchanged anymore under this. But they will remain unchanged under this. And there's that set of reasoning which proposes what kind of modification Newton's laws has to undergo. We have to rewrite them in such a way that if we make this transformation of coordinates instead of this one, they will remain the same. And then it's a matter of, with that clue, it's a matter of fishing around with the equation to try to find out how to change it so that if you make this transformation, it'll remain the same in form. And it turns out that the requirement is only that the formula looks exactly the same, except that the mass must go like this. Under those circumstances, Newton's laws and electrodynamics will all go together. And if we believe that when we could compare Mohs' measurements with Joe's measurements, we should have used this relationship instead of the other one, then we'll never be able to detect any phenomena, because the form of the equation will be the same. Any phenomena to determine that the thing is moving. This is called the Lorentz transformation, and just for the sake of discussion, this is called the Galilean transformation. I don't know how to spell it. Galilean transformation. It is also necessary, of course, not to just leave the thing here. It's all right to leave it here, but it's certainly interesting to try to discuss what it means that you have a new transformation between the coordinates and time rather than the old one, because this one seems to be self-evident and this one looks peculiar. And so the first thing to try to find out is it possible, legally, logically, and experimentally possible that this is the correct transformation and not that? So that in addition to studying the laws of mechanics, we also have to analyze, Einstein also had to analyze the ideas of space and time required to understand this transformation. We have to discuss these ideas now, and of course to discuss these results from mechanics, but I may say to justify all the effort that we're going to make, that all the results are in agreement with experiments, so that it's worth doing. In order to explain more clearly how people had intended to make this these effects, to measure the speed of the Earth through the ether, I'll take one experiment, the most famous, in fact, called the Michelson-Morley experiment, made in 1887. It was 18 years before it was finally straightened out. And this was the following experiment. You take a L-shaped thing, make the two lengths equal. Actually, well, that's a technical point, but you can essentially make them equal, or you can make subtractions, so you don't have to worry about that. So that this length here is L this way, and this length here is L also. And then the idea is this, that it's possible to take a beam of light and split it, so part of it goes down and goes back here, and the other part goes up and comes down, and to compare the times at which the light arrived with extreme precision, because as you know, light is a wave, and by making an interference measurement here, if there's a slight difference in time at which they arrive, there's a difference in phase, and certain interference fringes are shifted. So what we're going to try to do is to demonstrate first that we would expect a difference in time for going down and back and for going up and down if this whole thing is moving. Of course, if it's not moving, there would be no difference in time. But if it's moving, there should be a difference in time. Let's see why there should be a difference in time. First, let's analyze the beam which goes down to the end and back. Let's say it's going down, but the whole equipment is moving this way with a velocity u. Under those circumstances, the picture looks something like this. That if this is the original position of the bar, and the light starts from here, and goes down for a time t1 to hit the end, at the end of the time t1, of course, the bar has moved. So this distance is v times t1, the time to go down to the end, while the light traveling at the speed c travels all the way to the end in the same time. See, as it moves down, the rod moves, so it has to go a little further to get to the end. And therefore, since the length of the rod is L, we have that CT1 equal VT1 plus L, or that T1 is the length divided by C minus V. Of course, that's also obvious. The relative velocity of the light to the bar is C minus V, so the time to go down is the distance over C minus V. In a like manner, the time to return, to come from the other end back to this end, is in the same way of analyzing C plus V. Okay, call U V now. Because I obviously am never going to get it right unless I, all right, U. I'm sorry, I'll probably flip back a couple more times, but anyhow, we'll try. So here are the two times, the total time to go back and forth would be the sum of these two. And you add these two together by bringing them both under the same denominator, by multiplying this by C plus U over C plus U, and this by C minus U over C minus U, and add them together, and the U's go out in the numerator, and you get the following. That's the time to go down and back, T1 plus T2. But that's not all. We have now to calculate the time to go up to this end and come down. And that's a little more complicated, but not beyond our ability. Let's see. Suppose that the time it takes to go up to the end is T3. Well, then, if it starts here in the rod, was here, and goes for a time T3, then the rod has moved over this distance, a distance UT3, and now stands here. The light has to go this way and travels at the speed c, so this distance is CT3, and this distance is the length of the rod L. So we have a triangle which tells us that C squared, T3 squared, and so on. No? And therefore, it comes out that T3 is equal to L over the square root of C squared minus U squared. You see, if you square this, it says that. It says that L squared is C squared, T3 squared, minus U squared, T3 squared. But it must return also. So that the total time down and back, the return time is the same. So the total time the other way 2T3 is equal to 2L over C. I'm just rearranging the formula a little bit. 1 minus U squared over C squared. And this one I want to rearrange also to the form 2L over C divided by 1 over U squared minus over C squared. Thus, now they're both made. The reason I do it this way is that obviously 2L over C is the time it would take to go if the thing was standing still, and these are very small modifications. But look, the modifications are not the same, and therefore there's a difference in the time it takes to go up and down as it goes to go along, if the whole thing is moving, and therefore all we have to do is measure that difference. There's a little technical trouble. How do you know you got the lengths exactly right? Well, you just turn the apparatus this way, this way, this way, and so on, and measure whether there's any shift in the fringes. In other words, this is a technical point, but if you're worried about the fact that you can't get the rods exactly the same, if you take, if the time, for instance, to go down and back this way is longer than the other one, then when you turn it this way, this will become the shorter one, and the fringes will shift as you rotate this apparatus in a plane. So that's all. That's just a technical experimental point. Now, the effect of the experience was, the experiment is, that it doesn't happen. That is, that there's no effect of turning the apparatus. Therefore, there's something the matter with this analysis. And after mumbling around a while, Lorentz pointed out that it would all be straightened out if you will assume something, which is that when a rod moves in the direction of motion, it shrinks. That suppose, he said, that although L0 be the actual lengths of the real thing when standing still, that when they move, this distance is L0, all right, but that the other one is foreshortened and becomes a thing which we'll call L parallel. Let's say. And if we suppose, then, if we calculate this again, then that this should have been L parallel, and this should have been the perpendicular, which we'll take to be L0. Then, if we can say that L parallel is shorter than the way it would have been at right angles, L0, if we suppose this, then, of course, this one, the square root, will go into this, and it will make them equal. So he said that a way of remembering, of understanding that the Michelson-Morley experiment doesn't give any effect at all, is that the rod shrinks along its length. Well, there were many other experiments beside the Michelson-Morley experiment, and for each experiment, somebody or other concocted some kind of a gimmick like this that might screw up the experiment. Until there was talk of a conspiracy that every time there's a phenomenon, there's another phenomenon which undoes it. And ultimately, of course, as Poincaré pointed out, a complete conspiracy is a law of nature. So he proposed that that's a law, that there'll always be something which will do this. And that was the principle of relativity then, will be maintained, we'll propose as an idea that it's impossible that no experiment will ever work by which you could tell your absolute velocity, and therefore that all the pieces of analyses and all the gimmicks that have to be invented are, in a certain sense, real. Now, if we do suppose that this, now that's the end of the idea, and now I would like to say a few other things. First of all, it turns out, just a qualitative description of what happens, not only must lengths shrink, but also the times must be different. You see, the time T3 that I calculate for going up and down is not the same as the time that the man is riding in the spaceship calculates for going up and down, because that's this, and they differ by that. So that means that in the spaceship, times appear to take, things take longer to happen than they seem, when I look at the spaceship, than they do to the man inside. In other words, when I look at the man riding in the spaceship and lighting a cigar, he does it very slowly and puffs and so on, while for his point of view, it's going along at the regular rate. So not only must lengths shift, but the clocks must apparently slow up. And it turns out, by looking at this, that the clocks must slow up by the same factor, 1 minus u squared over c squared. This particular fact that time slows has been directly measured experimentally very recently. But, well, we'll come back to that, excuse me. Let me try to explain to you how it is that a clock will slow up in the moving system, because it's a very peculiar thing, and we'd like to understand these facts as well as possible. So we'd like to see how it is that a clock in a moving system is slowed up. In order to understand that, we have to watch the machinery of the clock and see what happens when it's moving. That's rather difficult. So I'll take the simplest possible clock that I can design. And that's the following. It's a rod with the mirrors at each end. This is a kind of a silly clock, but it'll work in principle. And light goes up and down. And every time it comes down, it makes a click, you know, a click, click, click. So I got a tick, 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 nice standard clock. So that's making ticks. Now I build another clock of exactly the same length. So I have two. When I have them next to each other, they agree because they're the same length and light always goes at the speed C. So this is a standard clock, the standard clock. Now in order to make sure that the man in the spaceship doesn't make anything wrong, I check the two clocks together and I give him one to take into the ship and to go off with it. And say, now, buddy, you've got the right time. We've got synchronized, accurate clock. So he takes one of these into the spaceship. Let me first remark that because of all these confusions, if he holds the clock this way, and he's in the spaceship now, and moving this way, then the length of this thing won't change. The reason it won't change is if it did make any change, I can straighten it out. Because as he goes by, I can put a couple of markers on, and he'll make scratches on his clock to where the lengths are equal. And if he wanted to make the markers on me, it's just as good. So we don't have to argue who's moving. The marks will agree both ways. So when you think of this, you see that you can make sure that these distances are definitely equal. That's the reason why, in this transformation, perpendicular distances, y's and z's, are not altered at all by the transformation. So these two things are the same. But now let's see what happens to this clock. We've agreed that the man who sits in the spaceship and looks at the clock is going to be satisfied as a nice standard clock. And when he goes along in the spaceship, he will not see anything peculiar. Why not? If he did, he'd know he was moving, huh? If there's anything changed because of the motion, then you can tell you're moving. But the principle of relativity says you can't, so nothing's changed. But when I look at what his clock is doing, I see that the rod is moving this way, and light only goes at the speed C, so that the light has to go up and down. You see, if this is the clock rod, then the light goes this way as the spaceship moves along, and if you follow the motion there, you'll see it's a zigzag. And we've already analyzed this zigzag. If in a given amount of time, this has moved a distance proportional to U, and this is the distance proportional to C, then this distance is proportional to the square root of C square minus U square. In other words, the time it takes to get from one end to the other is longer than it is in my clock, because in my clock the light goes straight, but in his damn clock it goes at an angle and has to go further because it's on a slant. And you see, therefore, that the apparent time for the ticks compared to my clock is slower in the proportion of this triangle. And that's where all those square roots come from, Pythagoras' theorem about this triangle. This is to that, is the slower. You also see that the faster U is, the more the inclination, and therefore the greater the effect. So that his clock would appear to go slower. Incidentally, that if the relativity theory is right, I say that any other clock made anyhow will also appear to go slower, even without analyzing it. Why? Suppose that I had to heck with this light clock. Suppose that I made a clock with gears and wheels and things, or a radioactive decay clock, or some other kind of a clock. And I made two of them exactly the same, and I gave one in the spaceship. Maybe that one won't go haywire. That's impossible. Because if it doesn't go haywire along with the other clock, see, imagine this, that we've set them so that when this goes up and comes down, this goes around once. So there's a double coincident flash. Ping, they agree. I can't do it. Bang, you know? Bang, it's on. So they coincide. When the light comes down here, this is always at the point. And when he observes it in his spaceship, that's also got to be true. Because if this no longer agrees with that when the spaceship is moving, we can use the mismatch between the two clocks to determine the speed of the ship, which we're supposing is impossible. Therefore, this clock has to run also slower in the same rate. And then we don't know the reason for that inside the machinery, but we do know, whatever the reason, is that when this one is up here, this one will be up here at this place, and therefore slower also. Now, if all clocks go slower, if no way of measuring time gives anything but a slower rate, we'll just have to say, in a certain sense, that the time appears slower in the spaceship. All the phenomena, his pulse beat, the way he thinks, the time it takes him to light a cigar, how long it takes to grow up and get old, all that must be in the same proportion because he can't tell he's moving. The biologists sometimes say, or medical men have told me, that it's not quite sure whether or not the time it takes for a cancer to develop will also change in a spaceship, but I think it's quite sure. Otherwise, you could use the rate of cancer development, for example, to determine the speed of the ship. Now, it is a very interesting example are mu mesons, which are particles which disintegrate. They come in the cosmic rays. They come down very fast. You can also make them artificially in the laboratory. When they are stopped in a piece of material, they stop, and then they'll disintegrate, not because of the material. They do it spontaneously. They also do it in midair. And they take an average of 2.2 times 10 to the minus 6 seconds to disintegrate. It's clear from that no mu meson can get very much further on the average than this time times this speed. Even if they're going at the speed of light, you see, for this length of time, they only go 600 meters. But actually, the mu mesons are made at the top of the atmosphere, 10 kilometers away from here, and they're found in the laboratory down here in a cosmic wave. How can that be? Answer. When they're moving, then they're moving very close to the speed of light. The time from in their point of view is this, but from my point of view is much longer. So they last longer and they get down here. And the length of time that it takes them to disintegrate on the average for moving mesons has been measured quite accurately for different velocities. And of course, the length of time they live is different for different velocities in the correct proportion as the square root. We don't know exactly what makes the mu meson disintegrate or what the machinery is, but it satisfies the principle of relativity. That's the utility of the principle of relativity. It permits us to make predictions even about things that we don't know any otherwise very much about. For example, before we have any idea what makes it disintegrate at all, we can still predict that when this thing is moving 9/10 of the speed of light, the apparent length of time that it lasts is 1 over the square root of 1 minus 9/10 and so on into 2.2 times 10 to the minus 6 seconds. And it works. That's the good part of it. Now, we would like to understand the relationship between these coordinates, between this system and this system, and I'd like to show you how we can understand it. We've already noted that the rods shrink. How can I say that prove the rods shrink? Well, we just pointed out the times must be equal. These distances cannot change. I gave the argument why, that this still is L0, so that in order for this not to work, this rod must appear shorter by that square root. That means that, from my point of view, the man who's making his measurements in here is using a foreshortened ruler. Therefore, if he measures x prime units with his foreshortened ruler, the actual distance that I would say it is not x prime units, as he thinks it is. He lays the ruler down 79 times. The distance is not 79 meters, from my point of view, but it's 79 meters foreshortened. And this one added to the V to the UT must equal the X that I measure. And that is the reason why X prime is X minus UT over the square root of 1 minus U squared over C squared. In an analogous way, because of the difference in time scales, that's the reason for the square root here. The most interesting term of them all is this term in here, because that's quite new and unexpected. And what does that mean? If we look at the equation carefully, it means this. Two points which I consider at the same time will not appear to be the same time for the other man if they differ in the position along the horizontal. If I say two things happen at the same time and they're far apart, and the question is whether the other guy agrees with me depends on whether he's moving or not. Let's see about that. You see, from my point of view, these two times are unequal. They differ. But from his point of view, the time to go down and the time to come back are equal. So there must be some reason, something which allows us to contemplate the possibility that the times, when I say the two times are equal from one point of view, they're not equal from another point of view. And it depends upon the fact that it's moved down a distance in x. To make a little more clear this important point, which is called failure of simultaneity at a distance, we can take the following experiment. I suppose that there's a man in a ship, which is again idealized as a rod, who is interested in making sure that the two clocks which he has placed at the ends of the spaceship are in synchronism. How would you make the two clocks in synchronism? Well, there's lots of ways. One way would be, with the least amount of calculation, would be to first lay out in here a place to stand that's exactly in the middle so that this distance is the same as that. Now that done, send out a signal from here, from the station, and the light will go both ways at the same speed, and we'll arrive here at this point and in this point clearly at the same time, and then I'll use that to synchronize the clocks. Therefore, a man in a spaceship will synchronize his clocks, let's suppose, by this particular method. Let's see whether we would agree that those clocks are synchronous from our point of view if this whole thing is moving. That is, he's got a right to do that because he doesn't know he's moving, so to speak, you see. But I look at him and I say, you're crazy. You don't have them synchronous. Because you let the signal out in the middle, you see. But while it was going down here, the darn spaceship was moving, and it has to go further. While on this end, the spaceship is moving, and it doesn't have to go as far. Therefore, this time is earlier than that time, even though you think they're simultaneous. That is, when the man in the spaceship thinks the two times are simultaneous, equal values of t prime for different x's must correspond to different values of t from my point of view, in order to get the t prime the same. And this is that term, and you can, in fact, obtain it by analyzing this in further detail. So that's the basis of those transformations. Now, we go on with this to see what else is. And the first thing is a very interesting. This kind of transformation between x and t is rather analogous to the transformations between x and y, which we studied when we had a rotation. You remember that x prime was something like x cosine theta plus y sine theta and so on. In other words, the new x mixes the old x and the old y, and the new y mixes the old x and y also. So here we find a new x, which is a mixture of x and t, and a new t, which is a mixture of t and x. So it's very analogous to a rotation, only somehow a crazy idea, a rotation in space and time. And in fact, the check that this is analogous is the following. It's possible to show by actually calculating the following combination, c squared t squared, or these are primes, c squared t prime squared, take away x prime squared, take away y prime squared, take away z prime squared, and just add it up. Square all these as advertised and subtract or add as advertised. Then on this side it comes out, it simplifies to the following. That is, there's a certain combination which is unchanged. Just like in three dimensions, there's a certain combination which the distance from one point to another, which is unchanged. And so the analog to rotations is very complete. And the analog is of such a kind that the idea of vectors, that is, things which transform the same way as the coordinates in time, is also useful, so that we have an extension of our idea of vectors, including a time component for the vectors which we used to think of as just space parts. This we'll analyze further next lecture. That is, there'll be vectors with four components, three of which you'll recognize as an ordinary vector, and one additional one will be tagged on, which is the analog of the time part. In the particular case, for example, of momentum, The fourth one is the energy. So momentum and energy are like space and time, and transform the three space parts are like the momentum components, and the time part is the energy. Now we can find out, now the question is to find out what the laws of mechanics are. We've explained how the lengths and all this change, but how do we get this formula for M? We can do that in an analogous way, but not analyzing such a simple clock, but analyzing a number of mechanical clocks, or mechanical electrical clocks, because we know how the electrical laws change, because we know Maxwell's equation, and thus discover what must happen in that clock in order that there be no change in the time. And it turns out that I can't do it. I got a way of doing it that's rather ingenious, but rather takes a little time to explain. It's possible to demonstrate then that in order to keep the relativistic invariance so that you can't measure how fast you're going, the mass has to change this way. I tried to get in one as simple as this one here. I almost made it, but not quite. Anyhow, we can deduce this relationship. Now let's, because we're going to study mechanics, I'd like to discuss now, having told you how it was found, what the consequences are of this change in the Newtonian mechanics. So we have a law erased up here that the force is equal to the rate of change of the momentum, but the momentum is given by mv, or still given by mv, but the m is different. To put it complete, we would put m0v, the vector, over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared right here, and now we have Einstein's modification of Newton's laws. What difference does it make? First of all, by the way, let's call this quantity something, momentum. And the momentum was going to be, I'm going to use a lot, a letter p as the vector for the momentum. We have p is equal to mv, of course. And this is the formula for m. The first thing is, what modifications? First, if action and reaction are still equal, which they aren't in detail, but they are in the long run, then there'll be a conservation of momentum in the same way as there was before. But the thing that's being conserved is not the old mv, the old constant m times v, but this movable m, this thing here. Let's get it exact, m0v over the square root. That's the change there. That's one place where we have to change things. Another place that we have to change things is in the formula for the kinetic energy. But we'll just, because it's a different form, and we have to do a little calculating to figure out what it is. But otherwise, there's not much change. The conservation of momentum still works, but we have a different formula for momentum. Now let's see how the momentum varies with the speed. This, according to this formula here, the value of the momentum for things moving at different velocities, if up this is a velocity c, looks like this. For a while, it's proportional to the velocity, because for low velocities compared to c, this right square root is nearly 1. But as you get nearer c, 1 over 1 minus c, if v is equal to c, that's infinity. So the momentum goes up this way, toward infinity. Therefore, what happens when you have a constant force acting for a long time? You say, oh, you can get going faster than the speed of light. Keep picking up speed, picking up speed. No, you pick up momentum, not speed. And so you keep picking up momentum, and you go higher and higher and higher and higher in momentum, but you don't get any higher after a while in velocity. Pretty soon, there's practically no acceleration in the sense that the speed is changing, but there's plenty of change in momentum. It just climbs up this vertical here. Of course, under a circumstance in which a force will produce very little change in speed, we would say it has a lot of inertia. And that's exactly what this formula says, that the effect of inertia is very great when v is nearly c. For instance, for the particles in the synchrotron that we use here at Caltech, we need a magnetic field to bend them, which is 2,000 times stronger than you might have expected if you used Newton's laws. In other words, the effective mass is 2,000 times bigger than the normal mass for these electrons. They're as heavy as protons in the synchrotron. That this should be 2,000 means that this square root here must be 4 million. This thing, one part in 4 million, 1/4 million. That means that v squared over c squared must differ from 1 by 1/4 in 4 million, or that v differs from c by 1/8 million. That's pretty close. In other words, if the electrons and light were both to start from the synchrotron and rush out here, Who would get here first? The light, because light always goes faster. How much earlier? It's so hard to tell you how much earlier that instead I'll tell you how much ahead. Because that's much easier to describe. 1/3 of a thickness of a piece of paper, 1/1000th of an inch. So they're going pretty fast. And when they go that fast, their masses are enormous, but they can't get going faster than the speed of light. Now let's look at some of the other consequences. It doesn't know how long. It hardly takes any time from its own point of view to get here. If we had a box of gas with molecules running around in it, and we heated it up, then we increase the speed of the molecules. But when you increase the speed of the molecules, you increase their mass. So the whole thing gets more massive when it's heated up, also heavier. This, therefore, it means that when you put energy and hide it inside a box, you'll find that the object is heavier. Let's get an approximate formula for how much heavier, as long as the velocity is small. It's interesting to see what happens if the velocity is small. When you try to expand 1 over the square root, assuming that this is small in a power series, using a binomial expansion, the first term is 1, and the next term is plus 1/2 v squared over c squared, so that the old mass is corrected by the following: 1 over c squared times 1/2 m naught v squared. Now, m naught v squared is the kinetic energy in the old-fashioned sense that I would put in here if I increase the speed a little bit. And therefore, we discover that the mass of this complicated object increases from not too high a temperature, at least so far, by an amount. The mass of the whole thing increases by an amount, which is the energy that I put in divided by c squared. This led Einstein to the suggestion that the whole thing can be summarized not by a complicated mass formula, but a much easier idea, that the mass of an object is always equal to its energy content in total. I may have to add some extra terms of energy to make it check out, divided by c squared. Why I said that quick remark about adding some terms is, if you multiply this by c squared to see the energy in the gas, you'll get the kinetic energy all right, but you get an additional, very large constant, m naught c squared. But aside from a constant, which doesn't make any difference in the definitions of energy so far, and now it does, then this will be the relationship that we can understand now how it works. When you heat something up, its energy increases and its mass increases in the same proportion. It's interesting that it's possible from simply assuming that the kinetic energy, that the energy is equal to the mass, to understand all the way this thing varies. Because it goes something like this. When I put a force on, I start the thing moving. That increases its kinetic energy. And therefore, since its energy has increased, its mass has increased. Its energy at the beginning, energy at rest, we'll say is m0 c squared, the mass at rest times c squared. But when I give it energy, make it move, then the energy increases, so the mass increases. Then I try to make it move more, give it more energy, mass increases still further. And so, of course, by some kind of equation, I ought to be able to determine what formula the mass has to be in order that this relationship be exactly right. Of course, for small velocities, I already know. This argument tells me what it was. Since for small velocities, I know that Newton's laws are right, and this is the extra kinetic energy, then I know that the mass must begin to increase like this for small velocities. But of course, once the mass starts to change, I have to change the analysis and so on. So let's try to analyze that. Let's suppose that the energy is the mass times c squared, and try to find the formula for the mass from that alone. Well, the rate of change in the energy with time will equal the force times the velocity. That's the rate of which work is done on an object. And in such an object, it would be the velocity times the rate of change of the momentum, mv, where m may velocity be dependent on the velocity. Now, in our attempt to analyze this, we're going to make the supposition that the energy is the mass times c squared. So this will read c squared dm dt. And my mathematical problem is to solve this. C squared dm dt equal this thing. Looks hard, but by a trick, it isn't hard. Multiply both sides by 2m. And then you'll find the following equation. C squared times 2m dm dt is equal to 2m v times dv, ddt and mv. Now, you know, to differentiate the square of anything, like x, is 2x times the derivative of x. Therefore, this says that c square times the derivative with respect to time of m square, let me put the c square inside since it's a constant, must be the same as the time derivative of m square, v square, the square of it. That is to say, m squared c square and m squared v square differ by a constant. M squared c square plus or minus some constant is equal to m squared v squared. What constant? How we define the constant? For the special case when the velocity is zero, let's call the mass m zero. Then in order for this to work, the constant that I must have would be m zero c squared. That's the way it'll work. It's now a question of complex algebra to show that m is equal to this there, right? I mean, you take this on the other side, and you divide by c squared, you get m times 1 minus v squared over c squared is equal to m naught squared. And if you take the square root and the divide, you get this relationship. So this is exactly what's necessary in order to make the energy and the mass square agree with each other. Ordinarily, these energy changes represent very small changes in mass, because most of the time we can't generate much energy from a given amount of material. But in the atomic bomb, for example, the 20 kiloton bomb, just so that I don't get into trouble with it. In a 20 kiloton bomb, for example, you can show that the fuel is lighter, I mean the dirt after the explosion is lighter by 1 gram than the mass of the stuff before because of all the energy that's released. That energy weighed 1 gram according to this relationship here. The maximum energy that can be liberated by anything. You say, here's an atom. I'm going to invent someday when I'm very smart a way to get much more energy than anybody else has ever invented. But there's a limit. We can measure the mass of that thing right away, and there's no more energy than this that you can possibly get out. This has been beautifully verified by the experiment for the where matter is annihilated. An electron and a positron come together. Each of them has a rest mass m, and if suppose that they come together at rest, then when they come together, they disintegrate, and 2 gamma rays come out. And what is the energy of the gamma ray when you measure it? M naught c square each. That is, the energy of these gamma rays when measured is m naught c square, which is a direct determination of the existence of the energy associated with the existence of the mass, the rest mass of a particle. I think that since we're going to have altogether 3 lectures on the theory of relativity, I won't make any grand summary at this point, but continue next time on the same subject. We've already checked that the time to go down and back is the same as to go up and down for equal rods. And we checked that. And so we know that's going to give the same time, because that's the business of the analysis of the Michelson-Morley experiment anyway.
Yeah. You were showing how a clock changes moving with velocity. You took the clock this way. Remember how you had the rods up and down?
Yes, this way. I moved the clock this way. This way? Well, let's suppose I put the clock horizontally and move it this way, all right? Because the spaceship is moving this way. I just put the clock down here. Then there's complicated. First it goes down at a relative speed C plus U and then C minus U, and then the length is foreshortened. And the result is the same. And that's what we did when we analyzed the Michelson-Morley experiment, isn't it? This is what we just proved. I don't know if I still have it on the board. No. When we analyzed the Michelson-Morley experiment, we demonstrated that the time from up and down and the time this way will come out the same.
And also,
you see, so those will agree. That's right. You see, we fixed it up so that this, by making this foreshortening just right, so that the time this way and the time that way are both equal. Here they are. This shows that after you got the L minuses and pluses here, or the parallels, after you fixed it up, both times were equal. So whichever way you set the clock, it'll read the same.
Were you also saying that if you put a man in a spaceship and sent him around space for a long enough time at a high enough speed, he'd come back younger than
yes.
his son would be?
Yes.
Yeah, but he'd have to be going off the path. But it's possible
yes.
to do that.
But you have to make sure he comes back before you make an argument about this. The reason is, I didn't emphasize, but this, from the point of view of the man in the spaceship, your clock is going slow too.
Yeah, because
he sees the same thing.
Still
exactly, yeah. So it has to come back, and then we get a deeper understanding. I wanted to make these remarks at the end, but I think I better leave them for the beginning of the next lecture.
Where did you get from down here?
Yeah, I'd like
M equals
that.
MC0 plus 1 over 6.
You got that all right, huh?
Yeah.
Right. This tells me how much heavier each particle gets when it's moving, so that the excess mass, the increase in mass, is simply the kinetic energy over c squared. So in this box of gas,
change of mass equals energy over c squared.
That's right.
Not mass.
No, that's right. That's right. This one here deduces only that the change in mass is equal to that. But Einstein went on and took a good guess that
is. In other words, this is an approximation itself.
No, this was we just demonstrated that the change in mass is the change in energy over c squared. In this particular case, for low speeds, okay? It's also true for arbitrary speeds, and that's what the burden of this analysis here is, that this equation still works, because any constant doesn't make any difference. So all we really proved correctly, all that's been satisfactory proved, is that the energy of an object is equal to c squared times the mass, plus some constants, which we'll never get from a differential equation, we can't get this constant. Just as you say, the changes in energy are the changes in mass. But what Einstein did is he went, looking at it, he just took a good guess that maybe the total energy is equal to the total mass times c squared. This relationship. Yeah. In fact, it turns out that when you start to understand the invariance better, it gets more and more likely that that's the right thing to do, is to make that constant zero, to redefine the zero of energy so that it's true. You can always change the definition. The really interesting question is whether you could ever extract the rest energy out. And I mentioned the experiment with the two electrons and positrons to show that, in fact, you can even do that.
This equation right here, the one emanating out of your box, where did you get that?
This?
Yeah, more right above it.
This?
Yeah.
From here.
But, well then didn't you work backwards? Move from there to show that E equals MC squared and then...
No, I was trying to explain how a new idea was discovered and I wasn't making a derivation. First of all, we find this formula from another argument. He got this a different way. That came later, that E equals MC squared. So I shouldn't deduce that from that because it's backwards in history. But let's say how the history went, and then we can, because it doesn't make a difference, nature doesn't care which is the basic law. So first you notice that the mass is increased by an amount proportional to the kinetic energy. Therefore, if you heat a box of gas, it gets heavier by the energy that you put into it. And that these energies will appear in nuclei when there are nuclear motions, excited states of atoms will be heavier, and so on. So you pretty soon get the idea that the other man was saying, that the changes in energy and the changes in mass are proportional. Now, if you assume only that, you can deduce back again that this is the right law. But the idea that the total energy, that if I add this constant on so that for zero velocity, there's a rest energy, which is m naught c squared, that at first sight seems to be an arbitrary constant from which you're going to measure the energies. It's just a convenience. But it turns out, in fact, that this energy is just as real as the rest of it, and that there are processes in which particles disappear and are replaced by other particles, and in those processes, this term does appear too. Of course, in the time of Einstein, you couldn't annihilate objects, so you couldn't verify that there was any sense necessarily to adding that, but it was right to do, and it's an extrapolation of idea. Now, my derivation here was meant only this way, that since this is such a simple formula, And it helps to understand how the mass increases, because the energy increases, therefore the mass increases when you push it. It's interesting that with this alone, you could have gotten this formula out. I mean, you can see the exact form from this relationship. That's all it was.
Yeah.
Okay. Suppose that as energy increases, the mass increases, so that the changes in the energy with time is the same as the change in the mass with time. But work done on a particle by the forces is the change in energy with time. I'm just saying what I was trying to do, the kinetic energy in the old days. So I get up to here. Is that all right? Yeah, now this is a function of velocity, so it's a little complicated to solve right away. But we have a differential equation, dm dt must equal v dot dmv dt. And it's possible right away in some more or less straightforward way to find out what n has to be in order that this checks. But I solved it by a trick to say, because you see, we don't know how to do these things in an organized way, so everyone has to be done with a trick. I erased the trick. You multiply both sides by 2m. Then this thing reads c squared times 2m dm dt, and on this side, 2mv times d dt of mv, all right? But this is easy because this is the derivative with respect to time of m squared c squared. See, the m is changing, the c isn't changing.
Yeah.
And if I differentiate that, I get 2m dm dt c squared, right? This one is likewise the derivative of mv, mv. Yeah. Consider mv as a thing, so it's the square of mv, so that this and this are equal, the derivatives. Therefore, okay, therefore m squared c squared is equal to, plus some constant that I don't know, is equal to m squared v squared, right?
Okay.
Because when you integrate a derivative, you can get a constant. Now the thing is, of course, you can call a constant anything you want, but you want to find a convenient way to describe the constant. Suppose we say that the mass for zero velocity is called m0. Then I have an equation that m0 squared c squared plus this constant is equal to zero. Therefore, the constant is minus m0 c squared. I'm so used to doing these things that I go a little quickly. I'm sorry. These things are for me so second nature that I can't remember that I'm sorry that I go too fast. Yeah.
Going this way, going from this equation to that equation, you expanded the square root of 1 minus v square root of c squared by the binomial theorem, didn't you?
Right.
Which means that you're taking an approximation.
That's right.
In other words, that's just an approximation.
No. This is an approximation which suggests that might be valid. And then what I did is I turned it, so I didn't explain what I was doing very well. That's an approximation, but this is, it turns out, exactly valid. And it's what I was trying to prove over here was that if you take this to be true, you can understand this. You can't go the other way, but you must understand the difference between deduction and induction. That means guessing a new law. And what I was trying to do was explain how Einstein came about that this thing, where this thing came from. Because he got another idea, you see. And he got the idea by looking at that and noticing that if you heat up a box, it'll be heavier. And then began to think about that. How much heavier? Well, the extra weight is proportional to the energy. Maybe that's exactly true. And when he integrated with this formula for the mass, he found, in fact, you see, you could also do it directly without worrying about this. You see, if you try this kinetic energy and if you substitute it in here, see, you can do it another way around. I just went the wrong way around. Suppose you tried to find a formula for kinetic energy blind. You never even noticed all this stuff. You just want the formula for kinetic energy. So you put in here m naught over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared is dE dt equals this. Then you have a fairly difficult calculation to figure out E, but it's possible. And it turns out the result is that E is equal to m naught over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared times c squared plus a constant. That probably would have been a better way to get at it. But this is, of course, also m. So it's mc square plus any arbitrary constant. Now, we'd be inclined to suggest that the energy should be zero when it's at rest. But Einstein said, let me take the zero a different place. Yeah, it wasn't a step. That's where I didn't make it clear. It wasn't supposed to be a step. It was supposed to be.
Really go from there to there.
No, you can't. You're quite right. Except by being a genius, which, by guessing, which is, of course, what every way the discoveries are first made, always. But you're right. It wasn't the derivation. I'm sorry I didn't make it clear. All right, sir? You want me to say the title 17 times?